Thank you, Carol. All right. So good afternoon, everyone. My task for this meeting was to give you guys an update on O3. Some people have touched upon some aspects of it. I'll go into that into some more detail. But before I say anything, the first thing I want to say is that the biggest perk of my relatively still new job is having a fantastic group of students and postdocs. So a lot of what I'm going to say, echoing Ryan from earlier this morning, is thanks to this wonderful, bright set of smiling faces that you see here. Of course, the second perk of being a professor at Caltech is having access to a beautiful mountaintop like Palomar Observatory, which has some really fun telescopes. And again, throughout the talk, I'll touch upon different telescopes from Palomar and what we've been doing in the last few months here. But before I dive into O3, I've been listening very carefully to all the talks yesterday and today, and I had two postscript remarks on the event I know we don't want to hear yet another talk on, which is GW170817, but just two slides, okay? Bear with me for just two more slides. I know we've all given dozens and dozens of talks on this. I sympathize, but just two slides, okay? So the first one is NASA's Great Observatory, the Spitzer Space Telescope, also detected GW170817, long after all the other observatories stopped looking. One of the advantages of the Spitzer orbit is that it can look really, really close to the sun. And after spending an incredible 30 hours on target, Spitzer did detect GW170817 at 43 days and even at 74 days. And the main takeaway from just two data points, and usually there's not much you can do with two data points, right? But in this case, these two data points came so late, so long after all the other gazillion observatories actively, I think 77 to be precise, actively observing this event in the first 3 weeks, that it actually has some very important hints of information here. The first point I want to make is that if you just take the fraction of electron heating, beta decay, I think we all know how to do that, half-lives of various radioactive species, this beautiful plot made by Kenta Hotakazaka shows that the first peak, A less than 89, atomic mass number less than 89, decays in a few weeks. And it's only at late time that the heavy elements, elements heavier than the first peak, dominate. So the fact that we detect anything at all at late time suggests that there is evidence for these extremely heavy elements in the second and third peak of our process nucleosynthesis. So I encourage people who are doing detailed kilonova modeling, even though it's just two data points and two upper limits, Switzer's warm now, so it only has two bands it can observe in, I think could help us, inform us, for what the future holds once JWST actually launches. And the second, again, postscript remark that I want to make, since there are some beautiful talks on stellar evolution and dynamical formation and all these different ideas of how compact objects form and merge in less than a Hubble time, one small comment that I wanted to add, which wasn't covered in the last day and a half, was this discovery of an ultrastrip supernova. So thanks to Palomar Mountain and Palomar Transient Factory and the intermediate Palomar Transient Factory that followed, we've discovered and classified thousands of supernovae now. That's not a big deal, but there's just one of them so far, in particular IPTF-14GQR, that looks like an ultrastrip supernova. So here we have evidence, in the first 33 hours, we have full spectra, which suggests that there was shock cooling, the core did collapse, we see flash ionized helium-2, so we know it's a core collapse, but the late time shows only 0.2 solar masses of ejecta. So definitionally, it's something stripped the star before it exploded. And the picture that you've seen in previous talks of how you start over two massive stars and evolve to this end system, we finally have a clue now, an observational clue in this region, which is thanks to this supernova, IPTF-14GQR, and I'm very happy to discuss this with experts in the room who understand cell evolution much, much more deeply than I do on what the implications of this one event and one very rare event here are. Okay, so those are my two slides that were snuck in, not part of the plan. The plan is to give you guys an update on O3 follow-up of gravitational waves. So as we heard from Ido, there are two events that so far at least are there's a neutron star neutron star merger and a neutron star black hole merger, and I'll go into these in some more detail. The reason I'm showing this figure is to point out to you that the second one, which was likely neutrons are black hole candidate, went through the galactic plane here, which makes life hard if you're a transient astronomer. There's a lot of variable stars that like to flare in that part of the sky. But regardless, you can also see that these error regions are so large that the only games in town really are things with large mapping speeds. This is not GW170817. This is not 30 square degrees. This is not 40 megaparsec. This is not 50 galaxies that you want to march down. This is this started off as 10,000 square degrees and was revised to 7,500. This started off as 2,000 square degrees and was revised down to 1,100 square degrees. So mapping speed is important. A large field of view is what is needed to really do attempt to do a search. It's difficult regardless, right? So I'm going to talk about searches by these two wide field cameras. It's Vicky Transient Facility, which is 47 square degrees, and Palomar-Gattini IR, which is 25 square degrees. So Palomar-Gattini IR is a telescope that many of you probably have not heard about. This is a brand new telescope that we just installed at Palomar Observatory with first light less than a year ago. It's a 30-centimeter telescope with a very fast focal beam. So this gives us a field of view of 25 square degrees on the sky. And every night, we're just imaging 9,000 square degrees over and over again with one-day cadence down to a depth of J of 16th mag AB. And this is just a pretty image of how M31 easily fits in one field of view. When 1904-25Z came along, this was pretty much data from just one gravitational wave interferometer localized to one pi of the sky. A year ago, I may have laughed when such an alert was issued and said, okay, it's time to go back to sleep, because there's 10,000 square degrees is just insane, right? I mean, that's just too large an area in sky to cover. But on April 25th, I did not go back to sleep because there actually are wide field imagers that can do a sensible mapping of these amazingly, impressively large areas. So with the Gattini, we imaged the tiles shown here. What I'm showing here is actually the updated map that came 26 hours later after we were done with our observations. So even though initially we had a one-third chance, which is not too bad, of finding the thing, later we only had a 19% chance. This maps need to come out faster. There are several LVC people in the room, so I'm going to be making this statement at least 10 times in the next 10 minutes. Okay, so what did we see with Gattini when we imaged 2,200 square degrees? The most interesting event that we saw with Gattini was this something that flared. So this was T0, time since merger. That was our upper limit from a couple of days ago and an upper limit from the day after. We saw something rise. So that's cool. It's consistent. It's spatially and temporally coincident. Okay. Of course, that doesn't mean there's an astrophysical association. So we got this very nice Keck spectrum here, and it shows titanium oxide. I hope some of you recognize this. It's an M dwarf in our own galaxy, redshift zero, so not related to the gravitational wave event. But proof of concept that if you go tile this large area, what do you see? And how many? And because we have this daily, nearly 1 or 2 day cadence on most of the sky, we have exquisite upper limits. So we won't be fooled by old things, old supernovae, old AGNs, things that have gone off, that are common but go off not exactly at the same T0 as the gravitational wave merger. So we could actually boil this down to only one candidate of interest, and that candidate is an M dwarf that decided to flare. So that was easy to close the case very quickly on that candidate counterpart. Now, with the same event, 1904-25Z, in the optical wave bands, we have this Vicky Transient Facility mapper, which is twice as big. It's 47 square degrees. So we could map even more area. In fact, we mapped 8,000 square degrees, which is quite amazing. We thought we would have 54% of the probability enclosed, but 26 hours later, LVC decided to shift the probability close to the sun, not just in the southern hemisphere, but southern hemisphere and close to the sun. So nobody could actually get coverage for this other half here, which is just painfully close to the sun and too far south. So the enclosed probability reduced to 21% here. But initially, this was before this, we don't wait 26 hours before we identify candidates. Our data is processed in 7 minutes. Shutter closes, within 7 minutes, we know what candidate counterparts there could be in the data. So we went through, now this is a very large area, So we had to work through a process to identify which ones are interesting candidates to follow up. Oh, by the way, LVC, please generate these maps faster. 26 hours is too slow. So we went through this process of trying to filter the candidates, and we start off with 50,000 alerts on the first night, 287,000 on the second night, and the question is, how do you narrow this list down to a handful that you can then do a deep drill and try to figure out which ones are at the right place, at the right time, and potentially even the right distance, where there's some information about the host galaxy that suggests that the luminosity is at least in the right ballpark for kilonova models. I by no means take GW17 or 817 to be the truth. I think that that is one. A first example, beautiful example, legendary example, but I don't start with the assumption that all events will look like GW17 or 817. I try to keep a very open mind in these searches as to what the potential counterpart looks like. And the thing that informs me the most is what it is not. All the other things that go bump in the night sky that actually I know are not related to this phenomenon. So there were two candidates that we were in the right place at the right time. They were minus 16 absolute magnitude, so very much in the ballpark of kilonova models. Given no other information, you would happily write your kilonova physics papers based on this. But we don't stop there, right? I mean, once we have a candidate, or two candidate counterparts in this case, we posted GCN, and there was a wave of excitement. And several telescopes around the world, including the Growth Network, which is an NSF Partnership and International Research and Education program, started to follow up these events. So the idea is as the Earth rotates, the sun sets in different places, we try and beat sunrise and get follow-up from around the world. So we were able to photometrically track not just these two high significance candidates, but 15 candidates that we could not eliminate based on the series of cuts that we made initially. As Cole hinted to, Growth is a team that never sleeps, thanks to our distribution in time zones. And we have lots of tools that we've developed through hard work in the last few years to help organize and automate follow-up of large numbers of candidates by large numbers of telescopes, by large numbers of people, and still keep all of this information quickly analyzable and react on timescales such that we get all the physics out of this transient before it fades away on us. So in the case of GW190425, these are some of the spectra that we got. Those two events that I showed you are the first two here. They turned out to be young supernovae. So not normal supernovae, but young supernovae. There are many other supernovae that happen in 8,000 square degrees, but we could rule those out because we're continuously monitoring the sky with ZTF and Gattini. There were two that exploded in the right time, right? So we had an upper limit and a detection, and the fact that they were young is important here. This one was red, but that was just line of sight extinction. It has nothing to do with the intrinsic reddening of the transient. This last transient here I show is actually a pan-STARRS discovery. I forget the pan-STARRS name, I apologize. But this event, there was a GCN by Peter Yonker who got a GTC spectrum. This fell right in the chip gap in ZTF, so we had no constraints from ZTF for this event. But there was a GCN by Peter Yonker who got a GTC spectrum saying this is the prime candidate kilonova of S190425. And obviously a lot of people jumped because he actually had an optical spectrum and claimed that the optical spectrum had features that look like a kilonova. So we immediately triggered Keck. Keck has a wonderful partnership TO program now. And what we saw was helium-1. And sorry, but this was just a boring type 1b/2b supernova here, not the candidate kilonova counterpart. Now, while me and my graduate students were in the Keck remote observing room, our phone rang again. This was about 30 hours later, right? And there was yet another event alert from LIGO Virgo. This slide was just meant to show that it was not just the two that we paid attention to. All the photometry of the rest of them evolved too slowly for them to be related. So those are easy to dismiss, but require additional follow-up observations. But 30 hours after 190425Z, 190426C happened. And this event was, some people were just too sleepy and decided to pass on this. Several of my esteemed colleagues told me it was just not worth staying awake any longer. But given the fact that there was a very significant probability that this was the very first neutron star black hole module that we were seeing. And this histogram is thanks to Jocelyn, because GRACE TB is still not updated with this histogram, even though GCN 24411 was sent out a long time ago. But Peter's trying to fix this. He said he'll try to fix it before my talk. But any case, since there was a significant probability that LIGO had just detected the first neutron star black hole merger, and at least any astronomer, any honest astronomer, would confess that we didn't even know whether these systems are real and exist, this was enough for me to stay awake for 72 hours straight. Okay, the fact that this was the first neutron star black hole merger, the map that we got initially 1 hour after merger was this one. So we devised a plan. We do have telescopes around the world. It was 8 a.m. Pacific time, so no luck at Palomar. The sun had risen. So we started with India, which at 1.5 hours started to map the North Celestial Pole to complement ZTF, which could not, or could not, we fixed that since, look at the celestial pole and the significant probability there. 7.8 hours later, two postdocs at Caltech, Igor Andrioni and Danny Goldstein, triggered the dark energy camera to get this piece of the localization. With Gattini, we could just get the whole thing. And with ZTF, we could get this piece here. Unfortunately, 20.5 hours later, the map shifted the probability to the north, but that was long after our observations were complete. So LVC, please generate your maps faster. Okay, I think I've said this 10 times already. Okay, so what did we find with this extensive search? We really wanted to leave no stone unturned. If this was a neutron star black hole merger, we wanted to find the counterpart and be very open again to what that counterpart could look like and not make any assumptions like this would be another GW17 or 817. So here's a list of candidates. Again, this was much harder. It was going right through the galactic plane. That really made the number of alerts much larger, and the usual rejection processes are just, they challenge everything that we do, all the machine learning that we do, all the different filtering that we do. But we were able to bring the list down to a list of about 15 candidates. So of these 15 candidates, now we were talking about an event that's much further away, right? It was at 377 plus or minus 100 megaparsec. Galaxy catalogs just aren't complete at those distances. So we had to resort to photometric redshifts. And so there were three candidates in our GCN that we highlighted as having photometric redshifts consistent with the LIGO-Virgo localization, and we encouraged people to try to get a spectrum. But if you look at the magnitudes here, right, we were pushing ZTF to 300-second, 600-second exposures, but the magnitudes are all below 20, with the exception of one CV that we found. So these are very, very hard for telescopes to follow up. And moreover, this was, if you look at the declinations, many of them are too far north for telescopes in Chile. So there was a temporary wave of excitement. There was one candidate that, again, happened at the right place, right time, right luminosity, in a very quiescent host galaxy, vanilla star-forming galaxy. It was actually fading really quickly. It faded by magnitude, we thought it faded by magnitude in 5 days, and it was in the center of the galaxy. So it helps all you stellar evolution people who want a supermassive black hole as a third object to form compact enough binaries. So again, there's a wave of excitement. Wave goes up, wave goes down. But it was unlike anything we had seen before. We got a spectroscopic redshift, and it was at the right place. In all of these, no matter how you project the space potato chip that Leo likes to make, it was consistent with the LIGO-Virgo localization. The theorists on the team, even with just three photometric data points, started to fit models. And we found it doesn't look like GW17 or 817, but it can very well be explained as a kilonova with high ejector mass and high temperature. Anyway, point is we were later able to rule this out. Okay, this is not a real event. But it was a very good exercise that we are able to find things that with absolute magnitudes minus 16, even if they're as far as 377 megaparsec and as coarsely localized as 2,000 square degrees. Of course, with these large distances, the role of the dark energy camera is unique. I mean, it's on a 4-meter telescope. It is much, much more sensitive. And in this nice paper that Danny and Igor wrote, you can see the upper limits. If it's like GW17 or 17, we'd find that it'll be easy to find. But even if you make some, you know, pessimistic assumptions on what a neutron star black hole merger counterpart could look like, you can still start to constrain significant parts of parameter space here. Now, but what the documentary camera searches really need is a better localized event. And for once, on 1905-10G, an event that nobody even wants to talk about anymore, LIGO actually released a new map in 6 hours. So 6 hours is much better than 26 hours, but so thank you for that. And the new map was so well localized that the dark energy camera alone could get G-band, R-band, and Z-band observations in 2 hours. We did actually, these two postdocs did trigger their dark energy camera program and collect this data. But unfortunately, after the data was collected, LVC decided to revise the probability that this event was terrestrial from 2% to 58%. That's just awful. That's just mean. Okay. If this event was not so significantly terrestrial, if there was a kilonova in this, we would have found it. And we did find lots of fun events in nearby galaxies, but we didn't trigger spectroscopy because this was a complete body pooper here. So in my last 5 seconds, because I have no time left, I'm just going to highlight this little red dot at Palomar Observatory. Please feel free to ask me about the Winter Project, which is a new telescope that we are commissioning at Palomar Observatory with a field of your 1 square degree using InGaAs technology. This is in partnership with Professor Rob Simcoe at MIT. I'll leave my summary up here, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mansi. Any questions?
Another comment along the same lines, which is not a question, but just a statement that, you know, I completely agree with the approach that you should go in assuming that this event looks very different. But, you know, if we had an event that had, you know, very similar chirp mass, you know, was at a distance such that the inclination was similar to 17817, you know, and we might expect it to look similar. Mm-hmm. And that information, some of it, is available and is not shared with the community. So my point is, I think there are aspects that, you know, if we had more information on this, we would know, okay, this thing maybe is in the same parameter space as events we've seen in the past, and we could. So I guess I'm wondering how useful would that be if you said, okay,
yeah,
I think it's going to be within a magnitude or something of what we saw
right
before.
I understand where you're going with this, Brian, but if I was to make, I mean, given all the hard work and lack of sleep in the last whatever few months, if I was to make I have an order of priority of requests from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration. And the first thing on my request list is I need updated sky maps before I trigger those telescopes. I need updated p-terrestrials before I trigger those telescopes, not after the observations are done, not after we've lost the sleep. After that, if they're feeling so generous, right, and if they're so kind as wanting to share more information before they write their papers, I would be delighted if they release additional information that's closer to their heart for the papers that they want to write. But I will, of course, use it as an observer who understands the importance of inclination angle and chirp masses, et cetera. But for me, that's not the showstopper here. The showstopper right now is these updates that just kill me because after we've collected the data to revise p-terrestrial from 2% to 58% and to revise Lal and Frintz maps to go from the north to the south, that to me is much more unfair. Yeah, so I just have an order of priority of my requests to the collaboration. Yeah.
Let me at least have an answer to one of these. I can't. Maybe the people around me could take ones. The updated p-terrestrial, which happened for the one example, this could not have come out earlier. Mm-hmm. What happened here, we have an instrument that's evolving. It does change. Its mm-hmm. characteristics do change with time. We don't like this either. It mm-hmm. makes our task hard. In this case, something changed in one of the instruments, and it started doing something that it hadn't done before, mm-hmm. and it continued to do it after this happened. Mm-hmm. 38 hours afterwards, we'd observed it do this in background lots of times, which
right.
then allowed us to say, yeah, this is more likely to have been a background event than it was when we were seeing it the first sort of one or two times.
I know your excuses. That's okay. You know? But 39 hours, I just want to point out that 39 hours is an eternity in the life of an astronomer, right? The telescopes are already all triggered.
I mean, you also have to deal with the fact that these instruments do this kind of thing. We aren't trying to hide these numbers. We are trying to get them out. It's not like we're hiding this one because we're going, ha, ha, ha. Right. We know this isn't real.
But I do know that. I do know that there are cases where the analysis is complete, but some board is still needs to converge, and some votes need to be done, and people need to decide whether or not to release information. And that is a slowdown that is not acceptable in this game.
I'm not arguing it's perfect. So, I'm definitely not arguing it's perfect.
So, and maps, you know, I think they can be run faster. You need more computers, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to say, I mean, I think LVC is great. I have lots of friends in LVC. I'm not, I love you guys enough to want to lose sleep over events that you send out. My team works very hard to respond to you guys, but I'm just making two requests. That's all.
So, I mean, also just in terms of like what is possible right now, not aside from questions of approvals or whatever that might hold things up, how fast do you need an updated sky map, and how many updated sky maps that are intermediate would be acceptable and useful?
I take 10 updates, an update every hour. I can modify my, we are awake. You know, our telescopes are robotic, but we are awake. We are looking at the data within minutes of the observation. 7 minutes after the observation, I have a list of candidates that I'm looking at. So if you have a change in plans, you have an updated map, I'll change my observations immediately.
What about the like ratty, not well converged preliminary indications that may be wrong?
That's okay. That's life. But what I don't want is 2 days later, or 3 days later, or months later, you try and change your p-terrestrial or your p and SBH or... I mean, there was a talk yesterday which claimed that 1904-26C was a binary neutron star merger, even though there was a GCN by the LVC that shows that histogram where it's clearly a neutron star black hole, if astrophysical, right? That sort of stuff is just, months are just impossible eternities. You cannot deal with those, right? I mean, minutes and hours are what are at stake here.
The humorous thing is economics is a good incentive. So if you remind these people that Keck time is $100,000 a night, Deccam is probably similar, and you're going to send them the bill for their incorrect things.
And how much is my sleep worth? So?
I mean, all joking aside, I mean, we've just raised the threshold. So part of what we're doing here is we're at threshold, but some of the time it's crap, you know, we do the best we can. I mean, so it's really this game, like if you want everything clean and perfect.
No, do the best you can, but you can do better.
You're not doing the best you can because it's information that you know that you're choosing to withhold.
Ooh.
Yes, well, before this gets any more interesting, I think we should thank Fancy again and go on.